in cash as a direct add-on to their regular compensation. The decision not to join PERS would have to be made within 60 days of appointment to that unclassified executive service position. The executive department recommends your positive consideration of this bill. There are several reasons why this change in law would be beneficial. Pardon me. We occasionally have difficulty recruiting for high-level agency head or technical specialist positions. State salaries for these high-level jobs are not always competitive with other employers, particularly in the private sector. Adding the PERS contribution to base salary may be the incentive that makes the difference that makes the hire possible.
Excuse me, Peg.
Yes,
6%?
Sir. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Does the executive department contribute on their own behalf to the PERS system?
The total contribution, Mr. Chairman, is 16.22%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The employer contribution is 10.22. The 6% is the employee contribution. However, it is paid by the employer.
That's what I thought.
That's correct.
So, in other words, the state's going to save 10% if we incorporate this system. I just want to make that point.
Mr. Chairman, we have submitted an amendment for your consideration.
I didn't see that.
Okay.
Aha. So now I see the state is not going to gain, but the employee is going to gain the whole 16.22.
Mr. Chairman,
if we incorporate this,
that's correct. If you consider the amendment we have proposed to 2091.
Right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Unclassified executive service employees new to state government often do not remain with state service beyond the term of office of that person to whom they report. They do not plan to become career employees. In this case, these employees may get a better return on the amount of their PERS contribution by investing it elsewhere for a longer period of time. We estimate that up to 54 individuals per biennium may exercise the option not to join PERS. Since this bill was drafted last fall, as I mentioned a moment ago, we have learned that there is no reason why both the employee and the employer PERS contribution cannot be added to these salaries. Consequently, we're proposing for your consideration an amendment to House Bill 2091 that would add both the employee and the employer contribution to the salaries of those executive service employees electing not to become members of PERS. It is our belief that this additional compensation would put the state in a far better position to recruit excellence in the top executive service positions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Domini.
Peggy, my understanding that one of the reasons why the PERS is as solvent as it is because of the number of participants who pay into it, even those who aren't able to draw much out of it, the fact that there is a large number of people that will be paying into the PERS system. Is that correct? That's my assumption of how come it is as solvent as it is. And my question is what effect would this have of allowing 1% or 20% to elect not to? And I suppose maybe we could even end up with as much as 50% at some point. I mean, if you wanted to take it to its fullest extent and people came in and says, I'd rather take cash than to go into PERS, what effect could that end result have if 50% of the public employees decided they didn't want to participate in the plan? What effect could that have on the plan? Have you thought that out at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Domini, the legislation that we're proposing would apply only to executive service employees.
What salary
which
level?
Is a level? Rather small.
What's the salary level? Have you got a minimum salary level for unclassified executive service people?
The salary level itself varies because we do have support positions in the executive service. This would include, and I can refer to the legislation I can get it for you and refer to it, but it refers particularly to agency heads and high-level specialists who report to agency heads, which would make up the unclassified executive service.
About how many people are we talking about?
Then, Johnny.
54.
Mr. Chair, I will get back to you with a firm number, but I would estimate that the total number is from 600 to 1,000 people.
So quite possibly we're talking about 300 to 500 people maybe, or even more than that, that would elect not to, in theory. I know your speculations are much less, but I can see it having that kind of an effect at some point, maybe not the first year.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominey, the proposal that we're making proposes that newcomers to executive service be allowed to opt not to join PERS. Many of the executive service employees, that is a number approximately 600, are already in the executive service, hence would not be eligible to opt out of PERS. They already belong to PERS and would remain so. This would apply only to newly recruited executive service employees.
I'm going to have Max read the ORS 240.205 so we can see what we've got.
204.205 sub 1 through 5 are the ones that you designate as executive service employee, correct? The unclassified service shall comprise one executive officer and one secretary for each board or commission, the members of which are elected officers or appointed by the governor.
And there's 200 boards and commissions.
Two, the director of each department of state government, each full-time salaried head of a state agency required by law to be appointed by the governor, and each full-time salaried member of a board or commission required by law to be appointed by the governor. Three, the administrator of each division within a department of state government required by law to be appointed by the director of the department with the approval of the governor. Four, principal assistants and deputies and one private secretary for each executive or administrative officer specified in 242.100.1 through 3. Deputy means the deputy or deputies to an executive or administrative officer listed in subsections 1 through 3.
Aren't laws wonderful? I can't read them at all.
Principal assistant means manager of a major agency organizational component who reports directly to an executive or administrative officer as defined in the first two, three. And five, employees in the governor's office and the principal assistant and private secretary in the Secretary of State's division. That's it.
When you start getting into boards and commissions and their employees, you start running into quite a few people there really quickly. But I would guess that your estimate isn't probably too far off. Seems to me last session that, don't want to mention any names, but we did a little special legislation for a couple people that I can remember to allow them back into the system after they opted out. Once you allow them out, and then, well, let me give you a little philosophy that was given to me when I was a student at the University of Portland many, many years ago. I had an instructor that was a priest that was banished from Notre Dame, but he was a good one. He was a dandy. He was an economics professor, and he always told the class, "Do not project the status quo." And this seems to have an application here where we've got these people that want to opt out because, you know, they're only going to be here for 3 years or you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden, they end up career employees in state government. And at some point down the line, they start worrying about their retirement. And then they come around to the legislature and they want special legislation to be allowed back into a system that they opted out of. Is that a possibility? I mean, it's already happened. It happened last session.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that most assuredly would be a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Are you finished with this testimony?
Yes, I am.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
John Satchel, OEA. The other side of the story. Who says that?
Call her.
This page two, is it?
Don Satchel speaking on behalf of the Oregon Education Association in opposition to House Bill 2091. I think it's a very ill-conceived, selfish piece of legislation, which is basically just going to increase the employer cost and either defer it to the future years and cause some instability in our system, or immediately increase the cost. At the current time, employees that withdraw their 6% in the system, and we're talking about usually short-term employees. There are some longer, but usually short. The employer contribution that has been made is used and remains in the system to pay the benefits of the system. So if those don't go in, it's going to result in an increased cost in the employer rate without any increased benefits to the employees. So, of course, we definitely oppose it. The second aspect, since this legislation was introduced, I've had both the superintendents and people within the private or in the city county indicate that they thought they would support it and they should be included. And if you pass special legislation for a special few, you will have a tremendous onslaught of people trying to receive the same type of legislation, equality, for themselves, which means that we are going to have problems in combating that, and they will desire that same type of legislation, which will increase the cost of the employer rate. The second aspect of that is that in the 20-some years that I have been here, basically every session there has been some very narrow special legislation requesting that they be allowed back into PERS because there was some legitimate reason why they opted out some years past, and now they want to be included. Each time we do that, and we pass that legislation, and those people are granted in, it costs the systems more money because they did not put in the employer-employee rate. They did not earn the tremendous interest rate that PERS has earned, and as such, it has to come from someplace, and it's the employer's rate. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
I know what you mean by the employer's rate, yeah. Not just the employer that's employing these people that want to opt back in.
Everyone.
Everyone.
Yes.
Yes. Any questions? Thank you. Mary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I'm not going to repeat what Mr. Satchel already said, other than to say that we agree with his evaluation of the bill. What I do want to add to that, however, is that we represent state employees, and those state employees are looking at the second contract in a row of a somewhere around 2% increase, unless we can break the spending limit. And I can assure you that after going through several years of no increases at all, and several more years on top of that of reduced or almost non-existent increases, almost an insult to what inflation has been, when my members look at a bill like this and say, gee, the boss gets a 16% increase on top of the 2% the governor's offering him, and if we break the spending limit, another 2%, so that means they're going to get a 20% increase while I get a 4. I can assure you that every one of my members is going to want to opt out of PERS and take the 16%, or a large degree, a large number of our members will. And so next session we'll be in here trying to not have to introduce legislation to expand the bill to affect all PERS members. I think that this bill is ill-conceived. It's an insult to state employees, and it's an insult to the system. This is a system that we get people in, we don't let them out. Last session, We did pass special legislation for very specific purposes for people who had been legitimately treated badly in the past. I don't want to be here 10 years from now trying to pass legislation or cutting some deal to let a bunch of management folks back in because they decided they wanted a 16% wage increase at a time when the rest of the state was taking 2%. And, you know, I just think this is very poor public policy to treat one group of employees differently than another. The system is healthy because we have guarded the system and we've cared for that system and we've not allowed things like this to happen, and I don't think we can start now. I think this is just, as I say, very poor public policy. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
No questions. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else? Pat, your turn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Wiegert. I'm the director of the retirement system. I'm here just to provide information on House Bill 2091. I had a question when I first read the language with regard to the coverage or the effect that this bill would have on people who are currently serving in the executive service positions. And Ms. Ralston already cleared that up, that it was fully the intent of the language before you to exclude those people. Only newly hired executives would be allowed to elect out of PERS.
During the first, what?
60 days.
During the first 60 days after they're employed. That would change the administrative impact on our agencies, certainly. And I don't see with 54 people perhaps electing out of PERS in any given year, I don't see that as being a tremendous administrative burden on our agency, considering we handle hundreds of thousands of those transactions every year. Not elections out, but paper transactions.
Unless it is a little small snowball that's starting to roll downhill.
That is correct. That is correct. One observation I would make is that there are other groups that I have been contacted by over the last couple of years that have wished or would have liked to have been able to opt out of PERS. I can think specifically of school district administrators who feel that they are portable and move a lot from one state to another, from one school district to another, and follow their professions, and so therefore being in one retirement system for a short period of time and a second state's retirement system for another period of time doesn't really suit their long-range financial planning purposes, and for that reason they would not like to be in prison, like to be able to opt out. So my guess is that if this bill is passed, you will see additional requests from other groups that for one reason or another feel they should not be mandated under PERS by virtue of their public employment.
Do we have, I've heard of a reciprocity concept. Have you explored during the time you've been director a reciprocity concept for certain people who do move from one state to another?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have. What you're speaking of is a portability provision in law. A lot of states do have reciprocity. Oregon does not have a reciprocity provision. We have, there are a number of provisions like that in other states where if you can demonstrate that you have totally closed out your account at your prior employer, this is oftentimes for teachers, if you closed out your account at your prior employer or your prior retirement system account, you can purchase the equivalent years or a portion of those years of service in your next state. Ohio has one like that. That's the one that immediately comes to mind.
You were at Wisconsin?
I was in Wisconsin. Wisconsin does not have reciprocity. The portability, the whole question of portability of pension benefits is one a person moves from one employer to another in the public sector, from one state to another, is gaining national interest amongst my counterparts in other retirement systems and also in Congress. Of course, within Oregon, we do have portability. You can move from one public employer to another within Oregon because they're all under the Oregon retirement system. But it's when you move across state limits, state lines to another retirement system where portability is really becoming essential provision that is being requested and looked for in all retirement systems across the country.
Well, no, that's not a part of the bill, but it is an interesting concept and something that probably will be explored in Oregon eventually. Do states that Iowa or whoever, do they just make agreements with specific other states that are willing to do the same thing? How do they do that?
Representative Woody, I don't think it's similar to a reciprocity in the driver's driving requirements.
That.
Yeah, I don't believe that there are any such reciprocity agreements between states. It's more a situation where a state will say that they will accept any, they will accept service from any other state. For example, I may be working in Oregon as an educator for 15 years and then move to Ohio. I don't recall what Ohio's particular purchase provisions are, but they may have a provision that says as long as you're working in Ohio as a teacher for at least 5 years, after those first 5 years you can buy additional service, Ohio service, equivalent to the years that you gave up in your, as a teacher in some other state.
You can only pay in the portion that was the members' portion. You can't pay the employer's portion.
Right. In those cases, typically the states may have a different, each state would differ, but oftentimes you can, what you do is you purchase the present value of those years of service. You pay in your member cost, plus you pay in the employer cost, or a portion of the employer cost.
Is there any case where one state transfers the employer's share over to another state?
No. And that's something that the states are working on right now as a part of a coalition of states, but it's not off the ground yet.
Well, it does kind of apply to what we're talking about, and that's why I think it was good to discuss it a few minutes. Do you have anything else on this bill?
The same thing that I would suggest at the earlier on the earlier bill, and that is that you make a definite effective date of January 1st, 1990 for ease of administration of a provision like this. Also, excuse me, one other thing I want to caution the members of the committee. If this bill is passed, a person electing out of PERS may have had a PERS account. So what they're doing is they're closing their PERS account. They can then withdraw their PERS account, close it out entirely, take all the money out, and they are no longer eligible for disability or death in service provisions if they are no longer a member of the retirement system. So they're losing some protection by opting out of PERS. And that's something that this committee should be aware of as you're considering this bill.
Chair.
Representative Dominey.
Just to follow up on what, in testimony we heard two things. One was, that wasn't clear at first, was who was going to qualify and who could get into this. And it was said to be a new employee in the executive branch. And that would be a small number. What would happen if a current executive were to quit today and start again tomorrow? Would they be considered as a new employee under this? Would this be your perception? I mean, for some of them, for that kind of a pay increase, may opt to do that. And is that a possibility, or is there a certain amount of time they have to be out of the PERS?
Doesn't say in the bill.
That's why I was asking.
Representative Woody, my reading of the language says that they can file this election within 60 days after the employee becomes an executive service employee. So if you're, in your hypothetical case, if I'm an executive service employee, I'm already one now, I stop and I start again, you got a good point. I'm becoming an executive service employee all over again, aren't I?
That's why I ask you.
I'm sorry, I can't clarify any further. That is a question that would be left unresolved if it's not addressed in the language.
Well, we don't do that kind of hanky-panky in state government.
Oh.
Anything else, Pat?
No.
Anything from the committee? All right. Anybody else? You might as well stay there, I guess. Anybody else on this bill? No one else? All right. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2091, and we'll go into a public hearing on 2049 and call Pat again. What do we have?
What you have before you, 2049, H.R. 2049, is housekeeping provisions that are submitted by the PERS board.
Oh, yeah, that's right. This is the bill that allows us to do almost anything we want, because you always bring that out. You're the benefit of the committee, don't you?
Well, the intent is to clarify and clean up language.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Why it's called housekeeping.
Well, we'll see if we can't adhere to that.
What I'm passing out are copies of a fiscal note that we prepared on the housekeeping provision, and also a summary of the number of the provisions in the bill, because the bill is rather substantive. What I'd like to do is just go down each one of these items on the summary very quickly and stop if you've got questions on the particular provision. I'll preface this by saying that for the most part, all of these things are clarifications, cleaning up language in the statute so that they represent either what we're doing now by rule or what we're doing now by administrative practice. What I've done on the handout that I've given you, the summary, is I've penciled in the page and the line number that references the particular change.
All right, we're on page 3, line.
So if you go to page 3, line 20, you'll find numbered the first one that's on that, that summary.
Gotcha.
Okay. Right now, there's a provision in law that says if you're a student, and you're going to school and you're also working part-time, you're not covered by PERS. You're excluded from PERS. That language has been a real problem in administering, because we have people who are working full-time and going to school part-time, and the question was, well, are they not covered by PERS too? That was not the intent of the language, and what we're trying to do here is clear up the language to reflect who's covered and who is not. We're trying to indicate that those people not covered by PERS are purely students whose principal occupation is as a student, and those people working on an educational visa that are aliens from outside of the United States that are here purely for educational purposes.
Do you have a problem with that at this point?
We don't have a significant problem. It's more of a kind of a thorn in the side, because we have a few people that where the question is raised.
I see.
The second one is on page 30, page 3, down by line 31. This is probably the most significant change in the housekeeping provision, in that it may have an impact long range over the retirement system. Volunteer firefighters are excluded as members of PERS unless their employer elects or contacts the PERS board and offers to provide coverage for volunteer firefighters. They're not treated as firefighters, and they're not given the higher benefits of police and fire, but they can be treated as members.
Well, it says volunteer. They're paid, though?
They're volunteers. I don't know that they're paid at all. I suspect if they're
how
paid anything.
How can you take 16 and two-thirds or 16 and whatever of nothing?
It's not easy.
Oh, okay.
The present provision in the law requires that the board and the volunteer firefighter employer, and I'll use that word employer very loosely, these people are volunteers, and the people that they volunteer for don't like to be called their employers. As long as the board and the employer get together and agree what will be deemed salary for their volunteer service, they would become members of PERS. There's a problem with that language, and we're suggesting a change to clear up that problem. Membership in PERS includes a lot of things, including a death benefit, withdrawal provisions, years of service accumulation, etc. Membership in PERS means a lot today, a lot more today than it did back in the 1960s, when we were not a defined benefit plan, we were a defined contribution plan, very much like a bank.
Max says that that there's already an estimate, must be a salary estimate of some kind, to provide workers' compensation benefits for those same people, so I assume that another segment of government has already gone, you know, far enough to allow them to be included in a system that is whose contribution is based on, you know, the compensation.
Correct. I think there are some legitimate numbers that could be used. What we're suggesting here is that the reference to membership in PERS be removed, and that instead the clarification be made that volunteer firefighters coming under PERS, at the request of the employer and at the approval of the board, mm-hmm. be granted a length of service stipend, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I've been approached by a number of volunteer firefighter organizations that have people that have that are interested in providing some sort of recognition of the long service as a volunteer firefighter, but they're not interested in providing a pension with all of the other additional benefits attached to that, like disability and death benefit, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So this provision would pave the way for that to take place. Long range, there will be most likely be volunteer firefighter associations approaching the board, asking the board to include volunteer firefighters for some length of service stipend. That will cause an administrative impact on PERS.
Any now?
Pardon me?
Are there any now?
I have been approached by several, yes. So they're waiting.
But you don't have any actually involved?
No, we have no volunteer firefighters now covered.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
The third provision is on page 4, and it also on page 5, and it's quite a lengthy one. It clarifies essentially that the length of service, that the retirees' cost of living adjustments are payable also to the beneficiaries of a deceased retiree. This is merely a codification of what we are now doing. We are now paying beneficiaries of retirees the same cost of living benefit that the retiree would have gotten had the retiree still been alive.
So what we're doing is changing section 2 to allow what we're already doing?
Yes, we are already interpreting the present statute to extend to